Our guest, one of our favorites, you know this.
Oh.
We should not show favoritism.
We try to be an
equal opportunity morning talk show.
I know.
But we do like him a lot. Former Senator Len Susio, good morning, Len.
Good morning, Len.
Good morning. Boy, you just made my day, Gary. I'm like, wow. I'm one of your favorites. That's a great start to my week. Thank you very much for the compliment.
Hey, that's how we feel about you.
That's right. I only wish I served on a committee with you when we were serving together.
That would have been a lot of fun. As you know, I cause a lot of controversy in some of the committees by challenging the leadership and some of the insane policies that the Democratic leadership was pursuing. So it was an interesting experience. Someday we should probably have a conversation about our experiences in the legislature. I think it would open the eyes of a lot of your listeners.
And when we do that, we're going to invite you in because I have a feeling that would be a worthwhile conversation. It'd probably take a little more than the 10-minute segment that we do for call-ins.
That's right.
I think people would find that very interesting. One of the things we love about you because you do shake things up. And what's interesting about you is that you'll become a senator. You'll win one election. You'll lose another one. You win again. And it's almost like a ping pong game.
Yes. Well, I always said you don't lose until you give up the fight. So if you get knocked down, just get up off your feet and go at it again. And
that's a
too
great
many
point.
People lose.
But
lose
you know, you tell people the truth.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Hey, by the way, I know we're going to talk about the pension controversy,
yes.
But there's one thing I just want to call to your attention if you haven't noticed it or talked about it to your audience, and that is this controversy over the Washington Post headline regarding al-Baghdadi and his death. In their obituary, they first had it as Islamic State's terrorist-in-chief dies. They changed it to describing him as an austere religious scholar. I can't believe this. And then finally, I guess a public outcry was so great, they changed it back to extremist leader of Islamic State.
What was their reasoning for changing it in the first place?
They didn't explain it other than they thought it was inappropriate.
Oh, my goodness.
but, I mean, call a spade a spade.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he was a terrorist, the head of the world's most formidable terrorist organization. And, I mean, you know, the things we saw on TV or on the internet, the beheadings and the brutal butchery, he was all involved in that. So describing him as the Islamic State's terrorist in chief was probably the most accurate way to describe him. But in these days of political correctness and...
That's taking it to an extreme. I mean, he is what he is.
You
know, a person who killed innocent people and was a head of an organization that is at odds with most of the world, you know?
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Why are we protecting? We shouldn't be protecting that.
Yeah, they not only did it, they broadcast it. They bragged about it. They used it as...
Yeah, right. Exactly. All right, so there's this op-ed that I want to talk a little bit with you about.
Yes. The op-ed regarding Connecticut's pension fund crisis.
Correct.
It's very true. The Republican American wrote that predicated on the article written by Mark Fitch at the Yankee Institute, Connecticut Yankee Institute, and he's right on. Connecticut is just facing a crisis of unprecedented proportions. It's truly an existential threat to the state of Connecticut's finances because it's beyond the capability of the state to honor those obligations. The obligations run into the billions and billions of dollars that are unfunded. And there was an article that was written a couple of years ago by one of the investment banking firms, and it said that basically for the next 30 years, in order to pay for Connecticut's unfunded liabilities, 38 cents of every tax dollar collected in the next 30 years would have to go to pay for that alone. And the national average is more like 11 or 12 cents on the dollar. So Connecticut's got an obligation that's triple the national average.
Whoa.
And then when you read into the op-ed and the Mark Fitch article, as you were pointing out, Connecticut employees contribute somewhere between 2 and 4% of their salaries towards their pension, but the national average is 7%, and some of the surrounding states, like in Massachusetts, is as much as 12%, New York 6%, Vermont 6.4%. So Connecticut's way below what the norm is for most states. And it's unfortunate because we're one of only four states that these benefits are a part of collective bargaining as a part as opposed to what it is for 46 states, which is just it's by statute, by legislation. So it's seconding it up for this impossible situation. And sooner or later, the state's finances are going to collapse because of it. There's no doubt in my mind.
So, Len, what a lot of people want to know is, number one, how long has this deal been in place, number one? And number two, why was it ever instituted in the first place when it's not sustainable?
Well, the CBAC deal, the State Employees Bargaining Agency Collective, is, you know, Governor Malloy negotiated the deal back in 2000. Well, first he did it in 2011, then he did it again in 2017. And he extended the benefits for 10 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unheard of to go that far out.
I remember this.
Unreal.
Yep.
Unreal.
Yeah.
Yep, we can't touch it for 10 years, so we're stuck with this obligation. And it, again, it's so overwhelming that it threatens the state's ability to sustain itself financially.
Yeah.
There's just no way we can afford it. And what Governor Lamont's done is he once again has stretched it out a bit more to try to delay the impact. But, you know, you combine these outrageous and unfunded liabilities with the fact that Connect is almost dead last in terms of economic growth. The gross product of the state is below what it was when the Great Recession hit in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a prescription for a disaster. It's a perfect storm. You have decreased economic activity, which hurts your tax collections, along with exploding payments for these unfunded liabilities. There's just no way the state can continue on like that. Sooner or later, we're going to have to face the music. And the longer we delay it, the more painful it's going to be. I would recommend, if you can ever find, there's a guy, an attorney named Chris Griffin. He wrote an article about sovereign immunity and unfunded liabilities, in which he said basically at any point in time when a state is unable to provide for the public good, because it's got all these unfunded liabilities, it can start negating these unfunded liabilities. I would urge you to follow up and see if you could have a talk with him. He wrote this article about 3 or 4 years ago, recognizing that this is going to be the situation sooner or later.
What is his name again? I want to write this down.
Chris Griffin. He wrote an article
for the
Connecticut Policy Institute. I can email to you the article itself.
Yeah, send that to our producer, Eric.
Okay. Do me a favor. Have Eric, because I don't know if I have his email. If he just emails me, lensuzio@gmail.com, I'll send him the article today.
Okay.
That's great.
So let me ask you this question. If you're a state employee, even a rank and file state employee, are you happy?
A lot of state employees are anxious, and rightfully so, because their union leadership, the union bosses, were complicit in this. This situation would have never happened if the union leadership hadn't agreed to this Faustian bargain with Connecticut's politicians. It couldn't have been done unilaterally by the legislature. It needed the complicity and the cooperation of union leadership. So the state employees, they all know that there's a real serious question about whether the state will be able to afford it and when the day of reckoning is coming. And they would have never been put in this position if the leadership of the union hadn't gone along with this nonsense. But they did, and that's where they are. And I know I have a lot of good friends who work for the state in various departments, and they're good people. I don't blame the state employees themselves. I blame the politicians and the union leadership that were in cahoots in this scam. The politicians benefited from suppressing spending, and the union leaders benefited because by suppressing paying for the benefits, they were able to negotiate more generous parts of the contract. So they both benefited and took advantage of it. And one was scamming the taxpayers, the other was scamming the state employees.
Well, keep in mind, Len, that the management of the union leadership are not being forthright with their rank and file members by they are disseminating inaccurate information. And they're causing rank and file members to just be misinformed.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I do say that the state employee union leadership betrayed the state employees. They didn't do them.
Oh, without a doubt. Yes, you're right. Yeah.
And as you recall, when Malloy was first governor back in 2011, remember that a lot of the rank and file resisted voting for the deal that was negotiated at that point in time. They had to have a do-over. They had to have a second vote because they didn't get enough votes to pass it the first time. And there was a lot of turmoil within the state unions, and there was some challenge to state union leadership. But again, what they did was the union's leadership changed the rules of the game and were able to preserve their jobs. I'm talking about the union leadership,
sure,
not the rank and file. So the state employees are in this terribly precarious financial situation. Many of them are concerned about how reliable their retirement benefits are, with good reason.
And they should be concerned. My district,
absolutely,
my district has a lot of rank and file state employees, and they would tell me off the record that they are not in support. Now, again, this is they were very clear. Gary, don't mention my name, blah, blah, blah. I can't even have a sign. I'm going to vote for you, but I can't have your sign on my lawn, the whole nine yards. I can't write any letters. But we've got to do something about these pensions. And he goes, and they'll be like, and I'm a state employee. And it's, yeah, you know, because what they're doing, and they look at it where they're putting it in one pocket and taking it out of the other pocket. And they're worried, quite frankly, that if things get so bad, that guess what? They're only going to receive about 55 to 60 cents on the dollar when they do get their state employee pension.
Yes, and again, Gary, I've heard similar comments from state employees that I know. They have good reason to be concerned, and certainly they should blame the politicians in Hartford, but they also should blame their own leadership.
Leadership, yes.
Who's responsible for negotiating the benefits and something realistic that state employees know they can count on, not this pie-in-the-sky, unreliable pension benefits deal that can't be honored by the state of Connecticut. It will, sooner or later, Connecticut will default. And when that happens, all hell will break loose.
I agree. We're heading in that direction. Hey, thanks so much, as always, former senator, state senator here, Len Susio. Can't wait to have you back on again, my friend. Thanks for being with us this morning.